In our study tonight, I want to conclude some things that we were talking about as it pertained to Naaman the leper. And there's just a whole lot of things that we need to talk about and some questions that I have for you. Some of it you may consider trivia, but nonetheless, I believe it's important to keep our thinking where it needs to be in our study of the events of history. Now, in our previous study, we talked about the works of Elisha. We're not going to go back and redo all that, except to note one thing. In the fourth chapter, as we discuss the Shunammite woman, we know that Elisha prepared for her and raised her, or I'm sorry, she prepared for Elijah, or Elisha, a room and prepared food. Elisha granted unto her a son. We noted that the son died, and we saw that Elisha raised the son from the dead. Now, in the process of all of that, we're introduced to Elisha's servant. What was his name? Gehazi. All right, we're going to talk about him. Because in the fifth chapter, we see Gehazi again, and then in the eighth chapter, we see him yet again. And we want to note some of the things that this servant of Elisha has obviously seen, and then some of the blunders that he makes. In the fifth chapter of 2 Kings, we were talking about Naaman. And we've noted that Naaman was a mighty man among the Syrians, that through him the Syrians had gained victories, but we note he was a leper. That expression, but he was a leper. We put that almost with equal authority as we do, behold, I thought, don't we? Those are familiar expressions to us. But as we look in this context, Naaman the leper was instructed by the servant of Elisha, which would likely be Gehazi, to go and dip seven times in the river Jordan, and thy flesh shall come again unto thee, like as unto the flesh of a little child. And in our study last time, we noted that Naaman said, behold, I thought he would come out and wave his hand over the leprosy and recover me from the leprosy. He had the little program already figured out. And he also reasoned, are not the rivers of Damascus, Pharpar and Abana, better than Jordan? Why not dip in one of them and be clean? And the servants, we noticed the plurality of that word, indicated to him, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldest thou not have done it? How much then rather to go dip in the river Jordan seven times? Now, we wound up our study Sunday morning on this particular point, that it seemed like a very good deal to those who were the servants of Naaman. What would inevitably happen to Naaman if he did not dip? Well, he wouldn't have been healed. The other side of that is he would have died of leprosy. People didn't survive leprosy. It was a death sentence. Now, in the New Testament, we know, and I believe, Randy, look at that for me, that it is in Luke chapter 4, though I'm not absolutely certain. It's in Luke 4, okay, where the Lord was saying that there were many lepers in the days of Naaman, but only Naaman was healed. Which verse?
Verse 27.
That's what I thought, but I wasn't confident enough to say.
I didn't really look that up. I thought, as evidenced by several different times, even here in the lesson we've been studying, that lepers had to be separate and had to warn everybody and announce them.
Yeah.
And how could he still be?
Well, this was God's law governing the Jews, that there were leper colonies, and they were to announce this and so forth. This was contained in the law of Moses. I believe in, is it Leviticus 11 or thereabouts, where we read God's instructions to the lepers. This is how that they were to separate themselves. Pardon me?
So it would just be the Hebrews.
Yes, yes. Now, we recognize that as a way to isolate contagious diseases. And indeed, leprosy was very contagious. And we see that these were the instructions of God, how that they were to isolate themselves to keep the spread of leprosy down. Now, another thing that we want to think in line with that is, how bad Naaman's leprosy was at this point, whether or not it was something that could be concealed. Keep in mind, he was a soldier. He wore armor. And where was his leprosy? Well, we don't know. How bad was it? We don't know. We've indicated in previous studies that it was a disease that caused your limbs to fall off, your fingers and hands and toes and so forth, just rot off.
But if God's going to do this miracle, wouldn't they want it, you know, I mean, it to be obvious that Naaman is a leper? I mean, if he's hiding it and then God cures a miracle, you know, does a miracle and he's cured, but nobody knew about his leprosy, then...
Well, his servants knew about it because to them they saw this to be a good deal. But how widely spread that knowledge was, it would simply be speculation. I don't know.
You know what they say about it, the servants know it.
Just backing up a little bit, it gets back to his servant. And he said to him, well, why not, you know, this might be some big thing. He's asking a small thing, why not try this? I thought that was pretty good advice.
Well, yeah, that's very good advice. Why not give it a try? You don't have anything to lose. It seemed to the servants that this is a good deal. You're not risking anything. If you are healed, then you'll live. And if you don't, you're surely going to die. So you're not going to risk anything. It's all pluses for you. The worst that can happen to you is get wet. But you're going to die of leprosy. It seemed a good deal to them.
But his ego was
weak. That's right. Yeah. Behold, I thought that it was going to be this way. And that's a hurdle to get over. When we have things all figured out that this is the way we've been taught or this is what we've been led to expect to believe about something and someone comes along with something that's different, though it be the truth. Behold, I thought, case in point, that we've used so frequently when we think about Jacob, when he had been led by his other sons to believe that Joseph was dead. Then when they came with word that Joseph was very much alive and he's in Egypt and he wants you and the family and all to go down to Egypt, what were his thoughts about Joseph? Well, I don't believe it. He's dead. I've already made peace with that, you see. Joseph's dead. I've accepted that. And only when he was persuaded by the wagons, the evidence that Joseph had sent to him, then his mind was changed. And sometimes it takes something rather large to change our way of thinking about things. And we see that illustrated here, I think, aptly with Naaman. Now, one point that we did make, again in brief, is when he suggests the rivers of Damascus. Damascus was located where?
In Syria.
In Syria. You see, why can't I go home and dip in the rivers that I know about? Why down here? In Judah, dip in the old river Jordan. Don't want to have to do that. So we see his desire to substitute something that he was familiar with for something that was commanded that he was not familiar with.
I was curious, do we know where on the map he was?
In Judah, no. It simply tells us that he went to the king of Israel and the king of Israel, of course, Jehoram, Ahab's son, became angry, thinking that the king of Syria was seeking a quarrel with him. And then it tells us that Naaman came to the house of Elisha.
Elisha, back in chapter 4, verse 38, was in Gilgal.
Okay. That could be the location then of where he is now. That's possible. And certainly we know that Gilgal was not far from the River Jordan. So that's a pretty good probability.
Did I read it correctly? Elisha wasn't there when he came, was he?
No, Elisha didn't even make an appearance.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. He didn't even make an appearance. He sent the servants and mm-hmm. Do this.
Yeah, he sent the servant. Tell him.
That further infuriated the king.
Yes. You mean Naaman? Yes.
Yeah.
He thought that at least the prophet owed him the honor of coming out and talking to him, but he didn't even bother coming out. Sent the servant out. That's right. So when we hear the truth, sometimes it's hard to accept. Sometimes we want to substitute something other than the truth, and we can make applications of that as we think about the substitutes for baptism, when we think about pouring or sprinkling, or there are many illustrations that we could offer to substitute something in addition to or instead of what God has simply said.
Sometimes it makes a difference who we hear it from.
Yes, yes, that's very much true. You know, regarding that point, somebody told me a long time ago that if somebody tells you the truth, even if it's the town drunk, you owe the truth enough to listen to it. And I think that's right. You have to give consideration. All right? Well, having said that, we know that Naaman went down to the River Jordan and he washed, and his flesh came again like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Very quickly on that, when was he made clean? When he had completed his obedience. Go and wash. Now, two things. Go and wash, and your flesh will be like the flesh of a little child. He had not washed seven times when he came up the sixth time. He had to complete what God told him to do. Now, in John chapter 9, during the ministry of Jesus, we read of a man born blind. And Jesus told that man to go and wash. And what would happen to him? Now, when would he see? When he washed. That little word "and" is real important. Now, if you're studying with somebody and you're trying to hammer home the necessity of being baptized, just to look at the commandment itself, not necessarily the purposes of the commandment, setting aside the entrance into the church, setting aside the entrance into the kingdom, as it were, setting aside the fact that you've become a child of God. When you just look at the commandment itself, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. If you want to receive the salvation, what must you do? Just believe. I think that's an appropriate way to try to get someone to see this point. In fact, when we're studying with someone, we approached this question from the standpoint of Acts chapter 2 in the discussion of the fulfillment of the promise, the remission of sins, what had been promised from Genesis 3 and 12 and so forth, as we've been discussing. And when the Jews in Acts 2 asked the question, what shall we do? Peter said, repent and be baptized. Why? For the remission of sins. Now my question to this young man was very simple. It was a series of questions. What did they ask the question for? What shall we do? Do about what? About sin. That's right. Peter just indicted them of crucifying the Lord. Now, when Peter said, repent and be baptized. Repent and be baptized for what? Remission of sins. Yes. That was their question. Now, when Peter said, repent and be baptized for remission of sins, the next obvious question is, when did they receive the remission of sins? When they repented and were baptized. You know how this young man answered the question? When they repented, he stopped.
It's funny because if you look at the phrase go and wash, and you look at the phrase repent and baptize, be baptized, both of them have the word and right there in the middle.
Yeah, and what does a conjunction do?
It's the same word, isn't it?
Yes, and what does a conjunction do? I'm not an English major, as some of you very well know.
It means both parts are obligatory.
That's right. They're not only obligatory, but it's combining two parts of equal importance. That means that repentance is not any more important than being baptized. It's part of the commandment. They're tied together. The illustration that was used when I was just a young fellow was two boxcars on a train are tied together with a coupling pin. That coupling pin is our word "and." And it ties together these two commands of equal importance. They're tied together. And you can't separate them. Because it was God that put that little word "and" in there. Now that's important, I think, as a tool to try to teach someone the importance of being baptized. Even from the standpoint of the commandment itself. And then you factor in the purpose of it. What benefit it is to us. Entrance into the kingdom or entrance into the family, and so forth. And then you see the relevance of all of that. But Naaman had trouble with this. But when he completed the commandment of the prophet, then he was made well again. Now, any questions on that?
There are any questions, just a comment.
All right.
About Jesus bringing that up in Luke 4. It's interesting that that was the last thing he said before they drove him out of town.
Yep.
He said there were many lepers in Israel, and only Naaman was healed. He was convicting them and their fathers of sinning to the point where they weren't even righteous enough to have Elisha heal them.
Okay.
Had to be a foreigner. And I mean, that's really what irked him, was that he was telling him, a Syrian was righteous enough to obey the command of the Lord, and you weren't.
Mm-hmm. Interesting observation. Hey. Yes.
I'm just thinking, I've been through a similar experience with that. I've tested before, and I said, where I am. But we should keep in mind the distinction as we can with another when we have in an often Lord's church, because ultimately what happens is they've been taught something from the time they were a baby to the time they're 20-25 years old. And it's hard all of a sudden, even though it's in front of them, to see what you're talking about.
You mean like Jacob? Yeah.
It'd be just as hard, and it takes time.
It had been about 22 years since Jacob saw Joseph. And now he finds out he's alive. That's hard to accept. It's hard to accept that someone's been wrong all that time.
Yeah. Well, first, you have to come to a conclusion in your mind. You wanted to test them in your church. I have to come to that conclusion, which is really a scary part of the truth, is I've been wrong all these years.
Yes. Yes. Now, Naaman, he hadn't been wrong long, but he was just as wrong. He would have died a leper. Now, pick up the reading there at verse 14. Verse 15. It says, "And he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and came and stood before him and said, Behold now, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore, I pray thee, take a present of thy servant. But he said, As Jehovah liveth, before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, but he refused." Now, we noted earlier the possessions that Naaman has brought with him from Syria in verse 5. He departed and took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 pieces of gold and 10 changes of raiment. He took a great reward to give to the man who could heal him of his leprosy. Did not Naaman realize that he would die? And here's a possibility to live. This was a great reward for the man that could heal him. Furthermore, you'll note in the text, Elisha refused the gift. In verse 17 it says, "And Naaman said, If not yet I pray thee, let there be given to thy servant 2 mules burden of earth. For thy servant will henceforth offer neither burnt offerings nor sacrifices unto other gods, but unto Jehovah. In this thing, pardon thy servant, when my master goeth into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leaneth on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. When I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, Jehovah pardon thy servant in this thing." And he said unto him, "Go in peace." So he departed from him a little way. What is it that Naaman is saying unto Elisha that as a part of his responsibility he may wind up doing? Yeah. Now that's interesting, isn't it?
Well, because he's expecting to by his master.
All right, but what does he know?
He knows there's only one God.
All right, now, here's a dilemma. What do I do? And you can wrestle with that dilemma just like Naaman did. What would you do? Say, I'm going to do it anyway, it's my job. Thought-provoking, isn't it? What would you do? Well, look at the text.
He's asking for pardon before he does
it. Yeah. Now, there's some things to think about there. Then we want to talk about Gehazi again. Verse 20. "But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, Behold, my master hath spared this Naaman the Syrian in not receiving at his hands that which he brought. As Jehovah liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him. Now, what's Gehazi been witness of?
I had a question. Back up in verse 17.
Okay.
Naaman said, if not, please let your servant at least be given 2 mules load of earth. Your servant will no longer offer burnt offering, no longer be sacrificed to the gods of the Lord. I'm not sure what that means.
I'm not sure I do either, Randy.
Really?
Let go, Richard.
He's taking dirt from the Holy Land, as it
were. Oh, okay. Exodus 20, verse 24 is the reference that I have. Here we go. It says, an altar of earth thou shalt make unto me, and shalt sacrifice thereon thy burnt offerings and thy peace offerings, thy sheep and thine oxen. In every place where I record my name, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee. Well, from this passage, we learn that the altar from which God would receive worship was from this. Does that make sense? From the earth. The Holy Land, yes.
He wants Israel dirt.
What he's
doing. He wants Israelite dirt, yeah.
He's taking a piece of Israel with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because of the text of Exodus 20, verse 24.
And we assume he knows the text of Exodus 20?
He probably don't. But Elisha does. And it may have been common custom at the prime time. I don't know. I don't know. I just have to think on that for a little bit. Yeah.
Trying to grasp. So Naaman has the loads of earth, and he wants to give those to Gehazi.
No.
No, he said, please let your servant be given. Naaman is sort of humbling himself and calling himself the servant of them.
Yeah. Naaman wants to take back part of Israel.
Oh, okay. That's why.
Yeah.
Let your servant be saved, let your servant save himself.
Yes, yes. He's recognizing himself as a servant to Elisha.
Asking for 2 mules of earth.
Yeah.
To
take back. Yeah. Yeah. No. Now, he's not asking this of Gehazi. No. Gehazi, now, has a problem. What's Gehazi's problem?
Greed.
Plain and simple. Greed. What's Gehazi seeing?
He's treasures and wealth. He's not going to take some. I'm going to get some.
Yeah. Well, we had mentioned that the order of events in this section are not necessarily chronological. We're going to see why in just a moment. But I would think it to be at least a very good probability that when we are introduced to Gehazi there in chapter 4 of 2 Kings, what's the setting there? Verse 12 beginning. The Shunammite woman. What's been done for her?
She was promised and then given a son.
All right. You think Gehazi knew anything about that?
Well, yeah.
Look, he was the one that suggested that she didn't have a child and didn't have a son, that is, and her husband is old. And so Elisha blesses her with a son as such, and when the child was grown, what happened to the child?
It
died. And what did Gehazi do about it at the word of Elisha? Went down there and took his staff and laid it on the child. Did Gehazi know the child was dead?
Yes.
Well, then, did Gehazi know afterwards that the child was alive and that Elisha did that? You mean he had been in the presence of one he knew could perform miracles? Yeah. And now what's he doing? Yeah, well, not just trying to be secretive, but he's a liar. Yeah, he lied to him. And why? Motivated by greed. Look at the text once more. Gehazi wants to go after him and take somewhat of him. So Gehazi followed after Naaman, and when Naaman saw one running after him, he alighted from the chariot to meet him and said, is all well? He said, all is well. My master has sent me, saying, behold, even now there are come to me from the hill country of Ephraim 2 young men of the sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and 2 changes of raiment. And Naaman said, be pleased to take 2 talents. And he urged him and bound 2 talents of silver and two bags, or in two bags, and with two changes of raiment, and laid them upon two of his servants, and they bare them before him. Well, let's pause right there. I want to suggest to you, number one, that Gehazi has lied to himself. He thinks that he can take something from Naaman and nobody will know it. There won't be any responsibility. There won't be any accounting. Well, that's false. He lied to Naaman. He said to Naaman that my master has sent me to gather some things, not for himself now, mind you, but for some of the sons of the prophets. In other words, that would be what we might refer to as the preacher boys that Elisha's training, you see. No, that wasn't true. And then you'll note that he lies to Elisha, beginning in verse 24. And when he came to the hill, he took them from their hand and bestowed them in his house. And he let the men go, and they departed. But he went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said unto him, "Whence comest thou, Gehazi?" And he said, "Thy servant went no whither." That's the reading of the American Standard Translation. Randy?
Nowhere.
Nowhere. Didn't go anywhere.
Nowhere.
Went nowhere. And he said unto him, "Went not my heart with thee, when the man turned from his chariot to meet thee? Is it a time to receive money, and to receive garments, and olive guards, and vineyards, and sheep, and oxen, and men servants, and maid servants?" Now that's a legitimate question. Did Elisha get paid for helping the Shunammite woman, restoring life to her son? No. No, he didn't get paid for that. Did he get paid by Naaman? No, he refused. What makes Gehazi think now that this is going to somehow be okay? You see, that's the question that Elisha asked him. Is this a time to receive all of these things? No. What was the purpose of miracles? So you could be paid for them? To confirm that the word spoken was true. Now, did Gehazi have any idea of that? Well, let's turn over just a little bit farther in the text to the 8th chapter. The 8th chapter. In the 8th chapter, reading beginning at verse 1, it says, "Now Elisha had spoken unto the woman whose son he had restored to life, saying, Arise and go to thy house, go thou and thy household, and sojourn whithersoever thou sojourn, or thou canst sojourn. For Jehovah hath called for a famine, and it shall also be upon the land 7 years. And the woman arose and did according to the word of the man of God, and she went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines 7 years. And it came to pass at the 7 years' end that the woman returned out of the land of the Philistines, and she went forth to cry unto the king for her house and for her land." Now, the king was talking with Gehazi. Who's the king? Don't think so here. Jehoram, the son of Ahaziah in Judah. "Now the king was talking with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, Tell me, I pray thee, all the great things that Elisha hath done. And it came to pass, as he was telling the king how he had restored to life him that was dead, that behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life cried to the king for her house and for her land. And Gehazi said, My lord, O king, this is the woman, and this is her son, whom Elisha restored to life. And when the king asked the woman, she told him, and the king appointed unto her a certain officer, saying, Restore all that was hers, and all the fruits of the field since the day that she left the land, even until now." Now I want you to picture this. The order of events, first of all, I believe are somewhat obscured in the text because it would be unlikely that the king would allow someone that was white as snow with leprosy to come into his presence. So that would likely put the events of chapter 8 preceding Gehazi's leprosy in the latter part of chapter 5. Now that's just a supposition on my part, but I think it's a very strong supposition. But as we see the report of Gehazi, regarding the question of the king, tell me the things that Elisha has done. What's so outstanding in Gehazi's mind?
Raised
the dead. That's right, he raised the dead. As he told of the Shunammite woman and her son that had died, and how that Elisha had raised him from the dead. And lo and behold, Elisha had told this woman to go down to the land of the Philistines because there's going to be a famine in this land. Now we know that the land of the Philistines was nearer to the ocean and likely it would receive a bit more moisture than it would in the area here of Jerusalem. But as we think of the report of Gehazi, in walks this Shunammite woman saying, I want my land back. Now we know that that was according to the law of God. It was to be cycled every 7 years. Go back to the original people that owned it. And she said, I want my land back. And what is the probability of this woman and this son who's been raised from the dead walking into the king's palace at the very time that the king has asked the question, tell me about Elisha? And he says, well, this Shunammite woman had a son, and he died, and Elisha raised him, and lo and behold, there they are. There he is. Now my question again is, what did Gehazi know about Elisha? He's lied to himself. He's lied to Naaman. He attempts to lie to Elisha. Does he think by any stretch of the imagination that Elisha doesn't know?
He didn't look for sure that he was a prophet. How are you going to lie to a prophet?
That's the point. Yes, that's the point.
Not to necessarily justify it. But when the Shunammite woman came to Elisha to say, my son is dead, he saw that Elisha didn't know about it. Because at that point, God had kept it from Elisha. So he knew that there were some instances where Elisha doesn't know everything. So maybe he was hoping that this would be one of those instances.
Perhaps so. Perhaps so. Perhaps so. We'll grant that. Small margin of error there. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go back in the text once again to the events of the chapters as they are ordered. We know in chapter 6, beginning in verse 14, I want to begin in chapter 6, verse 1. We've missed that. The axe head floated. It says, and the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, behold now, the place where we dwell before thee is too straight for us. Let us go, we pray thee, unto the Jordan, and take thence every man a beam, and let us make a place there that we may dwell. And he answered, go ye. And one said, be pleased, I pray thee, to go with thy servants. And he answered, I will go. So he went with them. And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down wood. Now let's pause right here. The way is too straight here for us. Wherever they were, what was the problem with it?
Too narrow.
Too narrow. We've got to have a bigger place. All right, can we go down to the Jordan and build some houses there? Yeah, go ahead. Will you come with us? Sure, I'll go. And so they go down and they start cutting down the wood for the houses. And it tells us in verse 5, but as one was felling a beam, the axe head fell into the water. And he cried and said, alas, my master, for it was borrowed. And the man of God said, where fell it? And he showed him the place. And he cut down a stick and cast it in thither and made the iron to swim. And he said, take it up to thee. So he put out his hand and took it. Now, when Linda was teaching the little ones in the back on this subject, she asked me if I had an axe to do. And it was loose on the handle, so I took the head off of the handle, and I brought it, and she showed it to the class. And I thought it was rather interesting. Can you picture little fellas handling an axe head? That's heavy. Now, what's going to happen when you throw it in the river?
Sink.
Oh, it'll sink just like a rock. It's not going to float. But this one did. Elisha made it float. It came to the top. And he said, just pick it up. Now, these are the things that Elisha did to cause people to believe that what he said was what God wanted done. Now, when you pick up the reading again in verse 8, it says, and the king of Syria was warring against Israel. Now, as he's warring against Israel, who's he warring against? What king? Jehoram. Very good. Warring against Jehoram. It says, and he took counsel with his servants, saying, in such and such a place shall my camp be. I think we talked about this somewhat when we talked about the king, Jehoram. But the problem that the king of Syria has is, I make these plans, and somehow they never come to pass. I plan to camp here and set up an ambush, and the people don't come that way. I move my camp over here and plan an ambush, and they don't come that way. How come they don't travel where I can ambush them? And what was he told? Well, yeah.
That was as if Elisha was in his bedroom.
Yeah, Elisha's in your bedroom, so to speak. He knows what you're planning in your innermost chambers. Do it.
When you were telling the story about the axe head rising, you know, I was struck by the statement you made about, you know, confirming the words that Elisha spoke, and we see that the purpose of miracles is consistent, constant throughout time. Because we see in the New Testament the purpose of miracles to confirm the words spoken. And that's exactly what we have here with Elisha working these miracles, like something like the axe handle rising. It was to confirm that he was speaking the words of God, that God was with him.
Yeah.
So you see the consistency of God of why he used miracles, not just throughout the New Testament time period, but throughout the entire Bible. It was to confirm the word of the person who was claiming to be a prophet.
That's right. Case in point, in our text, did Naaman believe that?
Yeah.
After his leprosy was healed, he said, I know that there is no God in all Israel, in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore I pray, take a present of thy servant. I know that there's not any other God but the one you serve. Okay? So you're right. We look at the axe head. We look at the war now that's taking place. And Ben-Hadad's plans are always known because Elisha knows what he is planning. Now, in verse 13, we know where he is. He said, go and see where he is that I may send and fetch him. And it was told him, saying, behold, he is in Dothan. Now, I perhaps have looked on the map to see where that is, but memory is not serving me well right now. I don't remember where Dothan is in respect to Gilgal, or really in respect to the Jordan River. If you want to look on the map, you can find that. But in verse 14, it said, therefore send he hither horses and chariots and great host, and they came by night and compassed the city about. And when the servant of the man of God was risen early and gone forth, behold, a host of horses and chariots was round about the city, and his servant said unto him, alas, my master, how shall we do? And he answered, fear not, for they that are with us are more than they that are with them. Now, we talked about that again when we talked about the king of Israel, Jehoram. And we noted in this that what Elisha's servant eventually sees is what?
An army.
So he knows now that God and one make a majority. And as we look at the text following, we know that these of the Syrians, when they encompass the camp and when they face Elisha, what does Elisha ask God to do to that army? Strike him blind. All right. Elisha said, that's fine, I'll lead you into the city. And where does he lead? To the city of Samaria. That's right. And when Elisha asks that their eyes be opened, what do they see? They see where they are. They're in the downtown part of the capital of Israel with the Israelite army, you see. So they're in trouble. Now, Jehoram, what's he want to do to the Syrians? Kill them. And what does Elisha say? No, let's not do that. Why?
Because they're helpless.
Yeah, they're prisoners. There's nothing that they can do. They're no harm to you now. So rather than kill them, what do you do? Feed them and send them home. And what would that do to you? That'd be demoralizing, wouldn't it? Be better to be killed than to be fed and sent home by your enemy. And so that's where they are. They go home. Now, an interesting note is, it tells us in the latter part of verse 23, and the bands of Syria came no more into the land of Israel. Now, we want to underscore just here that when it says they came no more, the point is not they did not come any more from now on forever. Pardon me? For a certain period of time, and we don't know how long that period of time was. In verse 24 it says, it came to pass after this that Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, gathered all his host and went up and besieged Samaria. What's happening now? Sometime after what happened a while ago.
Well, you almost might think that since they were given this reprieve and went back, they might have gathered their forces and come back right away.
Perhaps.
But
we don't know. Perhaps.
I can't say that I just agree with that one whole statement you said, that it's demoralizing to them. I think if you're an army and this just happened, everybody went blind. Did you go blind? I was blind too, and now you see. And then like I'm like, okay, they're probably gonna kill us. And then they're like, no, you're probably more like, well, first off, this is very powerful. I really don't want to mess with this. But then secondly, that you're grateful. So that's probably why.
It raises a question, though, regarding how much time passed before the army comes back. You know, do we have some of these blind men now seeing in the army of Ben-Hadad coming back to march on Samaria?
The New American Standard calls them Arameans.
Okay.
The king of Aram.
Okay.
There seems to be a difference. Verse 23 says, and the marauding bands of Arameans did not come again into the land of Israel. Now it came about after this that Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, gathered all his army and went up and besieged Samaria. It sounds like there's a difference between his army and the marauding bands of Arameans.
Could very well be. It may have been that there was just a portion of his army that went against Samaria initially that became blind. I don't know.
It could be that those who became blind actually didn't ever go.
It's possible. Yeah. It's possible. I just don't know.
I wouldn't want to mess with that.
I wouldn't want to mess with it, but you're thinking rationally. I wouldn't want to be Gehazi and lie to Elisha either, but Gehazi did.
It's a matter of reference. It looks like Dothan is about 15 miles north of Samaria.
Okay. Okay, not very far then. Very good. Well, we note that Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, gathered all his host and went up and besieged Samaria. We talked about that, I think, earlier, too. To besiege a city was to throw a circle around it, so there's no going in, no coming out. And the consequence of that is, you'll note in verse 25, there was a great famine in Samaria. Now, we talked about how that you would buy an ass's head sold for 40 pieces of silver. I have a note that I've written 80 days' wages. That would be kind of an expensive price to get an ass's head that you could boil the meat off the skull and all that supper. But that's what they were doing. It just tells us the severity of the famine. And Randy, I think you identified the dove's dung for 5 pieces of silver. Would you work 5 days for that? But they did. And perhaps we're glad to get it because of the famine and starving. Yes. And this was the condition in the city. Now, the king has a woman come before him. What king? Jehoram. Yes. Yes. Still talking about Jehoram, king of Israel. And Jehoram, king of Israel, has this woman that comes before him, and she's all upset, and he wants to know, what are you upset about? And the dilemma is, this woman and I made a deal that we'd eat my boy today, and we'd eat her boy tomorrow, and we've eaten my boy, and now she won't sacrifice hers. Now that's how severe the famine was. And so what does the king do?
He tore his clothes,
yes. In the latter part of the verse, it tells us he had sackcloth within upon his flesh, and he said, God do so to me and more also, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, shall stand on him this day. Well, he really hasn't helped these women that are starving to death, but he has said, I'm going to kill Elisha. Well, it didn't quite turn out that way. When you read the rest of this chapter, we learn that Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him, and the king sent a man before him. But ere the messenger came to him, he said to the elders, see how this is the son of a murderer has sent to take away my head. Look, when the messenger cometh, shut the door and hold the door fast against him. Is not the sound of his master's feet behind him? And Elisha simply saying, shut the door and don't let him in, because the king and all his army is back behind him. And so that's what we'll do about that. But then in verse 33, the chapter division in chapter 7 is unfortunate. Verse 33, it says, while he was yet talking with them, behold, the messenger came down unto him, and he said, behold, this evil is of Jehovah. Why should I wait for Jehovah any longer? And Elisha said, hear ye the word of Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah, tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel, and two measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria. Now this particular captain said, that just can't be. Even if God opens up the windows of heaven, there won't be that much food here. Now that expression, opening up the windows of heaven, is one perhaps that you will recognize from Genesis chapter 7 regarding the days of the flood, when God opened up the windows of heaven and it poured rain for 40 days and 40 nights. But that's the idea that's presented here, that if God opens the windows of heaven, there won't be that much food in Samaria, that it will sell that cheap. Now, you're going to ask me, perhaps, how much was a shekel? Because they were spending about 80 days just for an ass's head. They might boil the meat off the bone and eat that. And now we're talking about fine flour being purchased at a reasonable price. So you're going to want to know how much a shekel is, right? And you'll understand if I say, I don't know. Because a shekel was a measure of weight. The measure of weight depended on what it was a shekel of. It could be a shekel of gold, which would be worth more, wouldn't it? It could be a shekel of silver, which wouldn't be worth as much. It could be a shekel of iron, which they used to trade. We think a shekel and we think coin. And a shekel was not necessarily a coin. It was a measure of weight that was weighed out in exchange for a product. Kind of like you would take a bag of gold dust, Rick, to buy a particular product. You put it on a scale, weigh it out. This was a shekel. It was a reasonable amount, far less than spending 80 days for the meat you could boil off of an ass's head, and you could buy fine flour with that. Now, through the text of this, we know and have talked about the lepers that came upon the encampment of the Syrians, and they've all gone and left behind everything. And they began to partake of it and say, we're doing foolishly. We need to tell folks about this. So they send word back to the king, and King Jehoram sends a small party out to check this out. And they find all the possessions of the Syrians all the way across the river on their way back to Syria. And what happens then to the plunder?
It sells for a reasonable amount.
Now, when Elisha said to the captain of the king that you'll see it, but you won't get the benefit from it, where was he when all this plunder was placed at the gate? He was in the gate, yeah. And what did they do to him? Trampled him to death. That's right. And so that was the end of the captain of Jehoram at this point. We'll start next time at chapter 8, and I don't want to examine that in great detail, but I do want to call your attention to something by way of assignment. In fact, two things in particular. One is, I want you to identify Jehoshaphat in chapter 9. Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi. I was operating until I studied a little bit further that there was one named Jehoshaphat, and that's king of Israel, king of Judah. That's not so. There were multiple men named Jehoshaphat. And we want to identify this one. We want to talk a little bit about Jehoram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, and how it is that Ahaziah came to help the king of Judah in this battle, and how that Jehu wound up killing both of them in Jezreel. I want you to study and know why they both happened to be in Jezreel at the same time. So when Jehu came, he killed both of them. Why does he do that? Okay.